Those of us who are staying in here are going to be considering a title which actually I've purloined from a very eminent Christian author, Michael Green. It's the title of this book, You Must Be Joking. I called it Popular Objections to Christianity. Actually, Michael Green has subtitled his book, Popular Excuses for Avoiding Jesus Christ. Well, I suppose I want to give those who may be voicing some of the objections that I shall be illustrating tonight credit for being less evasive than perhaps Michael Green suggests in his subtitle. But it is, I think, important to realise that quite often the objections that people raise against Christianity aren't, strictly speaking, honest ones. And I've spent a long while in the last 20 years or more talking to people about Christianity one way or another, and I know many times when the old chestnuts, the old objections appear, I quickly discover that really they are more in the nature of excuses for avoiding Jesus Christ rather than real objections to Christianity. Sometimes they're very shallow excuses too. The person, for instance, who says, as we shall be considering a little bit later on, it doesn't matter what you believe, all religions lead to God. 9 cases out of 10 has never really investigated any religions at all. Sometimes, too, these sorts of objections are escapist. I know before I became a Christian, I had a whole stock of objections up my sleeve so that when any Christian came bothering me, I could throw one in and, like a red herring, divert him onto it and keep him well away from asking any questions or making any points that were at all threatening to me. The reason I begin by saying that is, I think we're only going to get anything out of our study this evening if we're all here really wanting to consider Christianity and these objections that we're going to be talking about with a high degree of personal integrity and sincerity. Lots of people, I think, try to deal with religion a bit like a sort of shop window expedition. Window shopping, as we call it. You know, you go around, you look in the window, you see the nice objects in the window, but you've no real intention to buy. I know a lot of people in this world who are interested in religion vaguely. They're quite interested in coming along and hearing talks about religion or reading books about religion. They have a passing knowledge about Christianity, perhaps. But deep in their hearts, there's no real intention to commit themselves. They're not really hungering and thirsting for truth in this matter. Now that, it seems to me, is not just rather dishonest, it's also dangerous. See, we're not in the position, we human beings, of people who are wandering around the supermarket taking down this can or that can off the shelf and saying, well, I wonder which one I prefer. To be a human being is to ask very fundamental questions about why we're here, who we are, where we're going. And it's those questions that religion is concerned with, and Christianity in particular. Every day that passes is a day of our life. It's a day which we cannot live without having some idea of why we're here, who we are, and where we're going. If we try and live our lives without answers to those questions, our lives have no real significance. What's more, every day that passes is a day that takes us nearer to a grave that we cannot really face unless we know the answers to those ultimate questions. That's why I think, whilst I have great respect for people who call themselves agnostics, you know, I called myself one once upon a time, I can't accept that agnosticism is a permanent place to be. It may be that we have to say, well, I'm agnostic, I don't know what I believe about Christianity, or indeed about religion in general at the moment. That may be the only thing we can say at a particular period of our lives. But I don't think we can settle down in that position of uncertainty. The questions are too important. The issues of our destiny and of our human meaning are far too vital to us. That's why I want to invite you tonight, not to just come along, as it were, and listen to what this chap has to say about all the old chestnuts that people raise against Christianity and toss them around in your mind in the atmosphere of a window shopper. I don't think you'll get anything real out of our meeting together tonight unless we come together in a real concern to honestly find answers on the understanding that if we do find answers, if conviction begins to grow in our hearts, then we're going to respond to it. We're going to be prepared to commit ourselves to it. We're not just playing games. We are in earnest. In order to make that point perhaps even more firmly, I want to begin by reading a little piece called The President. Now, some of you I know who come here regularly will have heard it before. But I think it makes the point very seriously that saying you don't believe in God, but are willing, as it were, to dialogue with him, to think about God, and yet without any real determination to commit yourself, can be a very precarious thing to do. Let me read it to you. One day, God knocked on the door of the president. "Who are you?" said the president, opening the door. "I'm God," replied the stranger. "Ha! I don't believe in you," said the president. "Show me a miracle." And God showed the president the miracle of birth. "That's nothing," said the president. "My scientists are creating life in test tubes these days. We've nearly solved the secret of heredity. Artificial insemination is much more certain than your lackadaisical methods. By crossbreeding, we're creating fish and mammals to our own desires. Show me a proper miracle." So God caused the sky to darken, and hailstones came pouring down. The president lazily picked up his telephone to the Air Force. "Send up a plane, would you, and sprinkle the clouds with silver chloride crystals." The plane went up and sprinkled the clouds which had darkened the sky, and the hailstones stopped pouring down, and the sun shone brightly. "Show me another," he said. So God caused a plague of frogs to descend on the land. The president picked up his telephone once again. "Get me the Department of Agriculture," he said to the operator, "and tell them to procure a frog killer, like myxomatosis for rabbits." And soon the land was free from frogs. And the people gave thanks to the president and erected laboratories in his name. "Show me another." And God caused the sea to divide. The president picked up his telephone. "Lob a few intercontinental ballistic missiles into Antarctica and melt a bit of the ice cap, would you?" The ice cap melted into water and the sea came rushing back. "I can kill all firstborn," said God. "A paltry trick," said the president. "Watch this." And he pressed the button on his desk and missiles flew to their preordained destinations. The world was split asunder and radioactivity killed everything. "I can raise the dead," said God. "Please," said the president from his cardboard coffin, "please, let me live again." "You?" said God. "Who are you?" Well, we're going to look at four popular objections to Christianity this evening. And the first one, which is also the first one in Michael Green's book, is you can't believe in God these days. I suppose the significance of the "these days" is that something has happened in the last century or so which makes faith more difficult for people. At least that's the common assumption. And I suppose the something that has happened that makes people think in that way is science. Science has changed our attitude towards God. There's no doubt about that. I suppose it was the mathematician Laplace who stated the point most candidly when he was asked, according to tradition anyway, by the Emperor Napoleon, where God fitted into his mathematical system of mechanics. He had been telling Napoleon how it was possible, using mechanics, using mathematics, to fully describe the universe, to explain the motion of the moon and the planets. So Napoleon asked him, well, where does God fit in? And Laplace is reputed to have replied, sire, I have no need for that hypothesis. I have no need for that hypothesis. As a scientist, I can describe the universe now without needing to bring God in, to fill some sort of gap in the argument. And I suppose that's why people say that science has made a difference. Faith seems more difficult, less necessary somehow, now that we live in a scientific world, where such descriptions of phenomena are possible without resort to God. Well, I simply want to reply to that objection in three ways, briefly. First of all, it seems to me, there is a practical argument against saying you can't believe in God. I think it was that practical argument that the psalmist in the Bible was getting at when he said, the fool has said there is no God. There is something essentially foolish, stupid, if we dare to say it, about the person who says they can get by without God. And the reason for that, I think, has to be that the alternative, you see, which science provides to believing in God, is essentially to believe in a meaningless universe. A universe which is governed by chance. When you look at scientific theories of the universe, it's chance which lies at the heart of them. They want to describe the phenomena in terms of the chance collisions of molecules and atoms. They want to describe the emergence of life and eventually of human beings as a result of the chance collision of chemicals, of chance changes in the genetic code, and so on. At the root of all existence is chance. Which means, of course, that the universe makes about as much sense as a game of Ludo. It's about throwing dice. It's about probabilities and random phenomena. There's no meaning there. No purpose. No destiny. Simply chance. There's no question, I think, that that's a deeply unsettling and fundamentally unbelievable thing for most human beings. I suppose Samuel Beckett, in his famous play Waiting for Godot, expresses it particularly well, when he shows the folk in this play just waiting for this figure who never comes. Godot is a sort of picture of God, who in Beckett's mind has been banished from the universe by the advent of science. And as a result, everybody's standing around with this gap, waiting for it to be filled, but it never is. And so everybody's life is pointless, they're just waiting for nothing, so it seems. Loss of faith, then, is no trivial passing from illusion to scientific rationality. What has happened to modern human beings is that in unbelief we've woken up to find the universe no longer makes sense. It's a frightening discovery. And that, of course, is at least partly responsible for the rejection of science that you find in a lot of people today. People are moving away from science, disillusioned with science, don't want to invest their lives in science, at university even. Fundamentally, you see, we hunger for meaning and values. And the alternative to faith in God is faith in chance. And that's a universe without meaning or values. No wonder the psalmist said, it's the fool who has said there is no God. Pascal was even braver. He put it this way. Belief in God, he said, is a wise wager. Granted that faith cannot be proven, what harm will come to you if you gamble on its truth and it proves false? If you gain all. If you lose nothing. Wager then, without hesitation, that God exists. He may be putting it a bit crudely, but there's a practical wisdom in what he says. The man who tries to live his life without God has to live his life without meaning and values. That's the practical argument. The second argument is the scientific argument. And again, it's summed up in the words of a psalm, I think, in the Old Testament. The heavens declare the glory of God. The strange thing is, you know, that the more you find out about science, particularly these days, particularly in the last 10 or 20 years, the less obvious is it that science has actually dispelled God from the universe. When I studied science as a youngster, it was certainly true that there were very, very few Christians who were scientists. But that is no longer so. In this University of Cambridge, I suspect you would find that there were far more Christians in the science departments than in any other. And one of the reasons for that is that modern science is increasingly discovering that you cannot, in fact, explain the universe on the basis of mere chance. Just a couple of examples of that. One is the account of the origin of the physical universe, the Big Bang, as it was called. Scientists believe now that all the planets and stars and so on, which we observe in the night sky, were propelled into existence as a result of a huge explosion at the beginning of time. The Big Bang. But the interesting thing about it, that Big Bang, is that it was not a kind of chance affair. At least it doesn't seem to have been. When you look at it in detail, as mathematical physicists increasingly do these days, when you look at it in detail, you realize that Big Bang must have been controlled with extraordinary precision in order to create the kind of universe we have. It had to fix certain values for fundamental constants, like the speed of light, and other important constants that define the way that atoms and molecules behave. If those values even differed from what they are by a fraction of 1%. The universe as we know it couldn't exist. Molecules couldn't hold together. Solar systems couldn't hold together. Galaxies couldn't hold together. In fact, more and more scientists are beginning to say that chance isn't enough to explain how it was the Big Bang worked out in the way it did. There had to be some ordering principle. Another example of the same thing, but from a different scientific area. This time, not the origin of the universe, but the origin of life. Now, we all know that Darwin's Evolution of the Species caused a great problem for Christians in the last century, because it seemed to be, at least to some eyes, demolishing the biblical account of creation. But again, in recent years, it's become increasingly clear to scientists that when you're thinking about the origin of life, as opposed to the way that one species evolves into another, Darwin really doesn't help at all. See, the evolutionary account of the origin of life is that somehow there was this chemical soup lying around in the oceans of the world millions of years ago, and as a result of chemical reactions taking place in that chemical soup, spontaneously, life chemicals were produced. Proteins and DNA molecules that were necessary to make a cell. And so a cell spontaneously occurred. Now the problem with that explanation is that it's now possible to calculate, since we now have a good understanding of the structure of the molecules of life, it's possible to calculate the probability of such molecules being created by chance in this hypothetical soup. And the chance comes out to be so infinitesimally small that more and more scientists are saying, we just can't believe in it. We can't explain life on a pure chance basis. All kinds of bizarre alternatives are being offered. Fred Hoyle, a very notable mathematician, believes that life must have arrived from outer space, guided by some sort of intelligence. Francis Crick, the Nobel Prize winner, has voiced a similar conclusion. Professor H.S. Lipson in the Physics Bulletin in 1979 concludes a very lengthy discussion on this by saying this: evolution cannot be a chance process. And the only alternative is to postulate a creator. Now that's a professor of physics, one of the most outstanding professors of physics of this century, actually, Lipson. So you see, the scientific argument is by no means closed. In fact, there's more and more gathering evidence that chance isn't an adequate explanation of this universe we live in. Although you still find very many people who don't really know what modern science is saying, assuming that science has long ago dismissed the need for God, just as Laplace did, having no need for that hypothesis. The third argument, it seems to me, against this old chestnut, this objection, you can't believe in God these days, however, is the experiential argument. See, the fact is, an enormously high percentage of people in this world claim to have some experience of God in their lives. No, you can call it illusion. You can explain it away with psychology or whatever you like. But that is the experience of people. And I suggest that you have to take it seriously. For my observation is that, generally speaking, that experience of God does not render people less human, less fulfilled. On the contrary, it enriches their existence. Once again, I think it's a play that brought this home to me most powerfully. Peter Schaeffer's play, Equus. I don't know if any of you have seen it. It's a play in which a teenage boy forms what you might call an obsession, I suppose, with Jesus, and has a big picture of him on the wall. But his father is an atheist, and detests this religious obsession of his son, and tears down the picture of Jesus, and puts a great picture of a horse on the wall instead. That's the reason for the title of the play, Equus, which is the Latin word for horse. But unfortunately, he doesn't achieve his object, because this boy, instead of worshipping this picture of Jesus on the wall, now starts showing an obsessive, almost religious obsession with the horse. He gets a horse fixation. He becomes absolutely absorbed with horses. So much so that the father sends him to a psychiatrist for treatment for this horse fixation. But the psychiatrist finds himself embarrassed. In a strange kind of way, as he talks to the boy in his therapy sessions, he becomes jealous of the boy. He finds that this boy's obsession with horses, far from being maladaptive and destructive to the boy's personality, has in fact enriched him. Finding this object for his devotion, even though it's such a banal one, a horse, has actually made this boy more mature, more fulfilled, more enriched as a human being. And the psychologist starts asking himself the question, well, how can I try and cure this boy of this fixation when it's doing him so much good? I think the thing that Schaeffer's trying to put across in that play is, you see, that it's natural for human beings to worship. And it doesn't matter what you do, they always will worship. You can make it as difficult as you like for them to find worthy objects of their worship. They will simply find unworthy objects. But even when they are unworthy objects, worship will still do them good. For worship is a humanizing exercise. That's what Schaeffer is, I think, trying to say in that play. It's something fundamental to our human experience and need. And if we deny it to ourselves, we are stunted. When I was a non-Christian scientist, I often used to quote the example of Galileo to my Christian friends. Because, as you may know, Galileo discovered the moons around Jupiter through his telescope. And he tried to tell the world about them. But the religious professors at the University of Padua, the leading church figures, they said it wasn't possible for there to be any moons around Jupiter. The Bible didn't mention them, so they couldn't be there. And so Galileo was thwarted and contradicted by this attitude of intolerance. He invited the professors of the University of Padua to come and look through his telescope and see the moons around Jupiter for himself, for themselves. But they refused. They knew there weren't any moons around Jupiter, so what was the point of looking? When I used to use that story, I used to use it against Christians. I used to say, there you are, that's typical Christianity, isn't it? Close-minded, you see? Not willing to look at the facts. Actually, I've since discovered that as often as not, it isn't the Christians who are closing their minds to the facts. It's the non-Christians, who, though they feel in their hearts, if they're honest, this burning need, which we human beings all share, to worship that which is greater than ourselves, they will not admit it's there. They won't look in the telescope. You can't believe in God these days? Well, there's an awful lot of people that find they can. Well, now for the other three of our popular objections. At the end of our examination of the first one, you can't believe in God these days, we spoke about the universality of the hunger for God and the vast number of people that do, in some way or another, claim that they experience God in their lives. Now that, of course, is something the Bible itself recognizes very candidly. The Apostle Paul, when he was speaking to Athenians who knew nothing at all about Christianity, commented about their religious experience and mentioned how their own poets had said, God isn't far from any of us. But that, of course, raises another very popular objection to Christianity. All religions lead to God. I've just outlined three there, Buddhism and Hinduism and Islam. But, of course, there are many others in this world. And it's very tempting in these days in which we live, where international cooperation is so important, where immigrant communities are coming into our society, that it's very tempting to take that, what appears to be, very tolerant and open-minded view. All religions lead to God. Somebody I always admired very greatly, Mahatma Gandhi, put it in a very simple way. He said, the soul of all religions is one, but it's encased in a multitude of forms. Truth is the exclusive property of no single scripture. I cannot ascribe exclusive divinity to Jesus. He is as divine as Krishna or Muhammad. An interesting picture then. The essential experience, this religious experience that people talk about, he's saying, that is universal. And all the different religions of the world are different ways of trying to understand and institutionalize and encase that experience. The soul of all religions is one, but you find that soul embodied in many different ways. Now, as I say, it sounds very plausible, but I think there are overwhelming objections to that view. It doesn't take very much, I think, to identify them. The first is, it's illogical. Because when you look at the multitude of world religions, I mean examine what they actually believe, rather than look at them from a sentimental distance, you find that they are all preaching different gods. Not one god at all. The god of Hinduism and Buddhism is impersonal. In many cases, viewed as some kind of a field of spiritual energy. The god of Islam is personal but solitary. The God of Christianity is super-personal. Three persons in one. The Trinity. These three and many other different gods which are portrayed by different religions are incompatible with one another, as representatives of these different religions will candidly admit. That's why you'll never find a Muslim saying he can agree with a Christian. There's no way, you see, that his idea of God can be squeezed into the Christian idea of God. We can have helpful dialogue about our religious experience, and I've met many Muslims who I admire enormously and who I'm quite convinced have a deeper understanding of God and of the real meaning of religion than many who have grown up in a Christian country that I could mention. But there's no way these different gods can really be regarded as one. Similarly, these different religions have different ideas of what it means to find salvation. For instance, Buddhism. Buddhism regards salvation for us human beings as extinction, the complete loss of our personal identity. That's what the Buddhist hopes for. But of course, Christianity looks forward to a new heaven and a new earth in which all human beings, at least all redeemed human beings, all saved human beings, will retain their personal existence and find that personal existence enriched and deepened rather than bankrupted or of less significance. Perhaps most important of all, these different religions all speak of different ways of finding salvation. If you think of them as routes on a map, they're all pointing in different directions. So how can they be all heading for the same goal? Eastern religions put a lot of emphasis, for instance, on karma, as it's called. That is, good works which enable you to climb up the pathway to reincarnation. Or they may speak a lot about yoga disciplines, which are designed to lead you to some kind of spiritual enlightenment. Islam speaks a lot about obedience. An almost, one could say, I think, fatalistic resignation to the will of God. Christianity, on the other hand, insists that salvation is not something that man achieves, either by his record of good karma or by his record of obedience. Christianity insists that salvation is something that has to come from the free grace and mercy of God. And that's where Jesus comes in for the Christian. He's not thought of as simply a prophet who came to tell us how to get to God, to define the technique we needed, to plot the route. Jesus, in Christianity, is a saviour figure who actually comes to achieve salvation for us, to bring it to us, if you dare to put it this way, on a plate. Not saying, do this and do this and do this and you'll make it, but I have come because you can't make it. So I've come to make it for you. Now that, of course, introduces us to a subject which is closely related to this one. All religions lead to God. And that's the third objection. That Jesus was just a good man. See, ultimately, the problem I have with this idea that all religions lead to God is that I cannot make sense of Jesus on that basis. I can't put Christianity alongside these other great religious leaders, though I admire them enormously. Over the past few years, I've tried to read a bit about many of these other religions and the great religious leaders and prophets and so on who inspired them. And there's no question that many of them were great men and had great insight. But I don't find one of them that comes anywhere near Jesus. I'd like for a few moments to just try to explain why I feel that, why it will not do to put Jesus alongside these other good men as just another one of that category. The first reason I find that difficult is because of Jesus' teaching. You know, it's impossible to read the gospel records of Jesus without being shocked by the extraordinary egocentricity of much of what Jesus says. I mean, for instance, Jesus, on one occasion, in the Sermon on the Mount, which is regarded as, by many, I suppose, the epitome of his teaching, he said that one day, on the day of judgment, people would come to him and they would say, "Lord, Lord." And he would have the power to say to some of them, "Depart from me, I never knew you." He says in that Sermon on the Mount, the only people who have any chance of standing in the day of judgment and surviving are people who have built their lives on obedience to my words, who have listened and obeyed my words. People who have not done that, who have heard my words and have rejected them, they're people who are building their lives on the sand. Let's think of the implications of that. People will come to me on judgment day and call me Lord. I will be in charge of saying who goes to heaven and who doesn't. Only by building your life on obedience to my words will you be secure. It's no wonder, is it, that we read the crowds were always marveling when Jesus preached because he didn't talk the way other people did. The Greek philosophers, whom they had heard of, would always say, "This is my opinion." The rabbis, who taught around their country, would often say, "This is what the Bible says." Even the great prophets that they read about in the Bible would only go so far as saying, "Here is the word of the Lord." But with Jesus, it was, "I say unto you, heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away." There was this authority, this egocentricity permeating his whole ministry. It shows in the titles he arrogated to himself too. "I am the bread of life. I am the resurrection and the life. I am the light of the world." It shows in the prerogatives which he asserted. "Your sins are forgiven you," he said. Everybody knew that the only person who could forgive sins is God. But Jesus claimed he had personal authority to do that. But perhaps most staggering of all, there were the claims he made. Like this one. "I and my Father are one. I came forth out of God." just read what he says. I came forth out of God. We were thinking the other Sunday morning of how on one occasion he asked the disciples whom people said he was, what the opinion of him was, and how they had various ideas on this score. But eventually Peter, one of the disciples, said to him, I know who you are. You are the Son of the living God. What was one to expect Jesus' response to that to be? No, Peter, you mustn't say such a foolish thing. I'm a person like you. You're letting your enthusiasm run away with you. I'm just an ordinary human being. Just a good man. No, that wasn't what he said at all. He said, you are blessed, Peter. Flesh and blood hasn't revealed this to you. My Father in heaven has revealed it to you. In other words, he accepted that preposterous title. In fact, at his trial, they mentioned it to him. Are you the Son of God? They asked him. And it would have been most easy for him to deny it, and if he had denied it, he wouldn't have gone to the cross. But instead, we read, he told them, you will see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of the Almighty and coming with the clouds of heaven. No great religious leader in his right mind has ever claimed this kind of divine authority. C.S. Lewis always puts these things well. This is how he put it. If you had gone to Buddha and asked him, are you the son of Brahman? He would have said, my son, you are still in the veil of illusion. If you had gone to Socrates and asked, are you Zeus? He would have laughed at you. If you had gone to Muhammad and asked, are you Allah? He would have cut off your head. But Jesus said, he who has seen me has seen the Father. Now, as I say, this just does not fit this picture of a good man, does it? And there are other things about him, too. The devotion that he demanded of his disciples, for instance. Unless, he said on one occasion, unless your devotion to me is far greater than your devotion to your family, you can't be my disciple. Now, can you imagine a good man saying that? Can you imagine me trying to say that to you? You must be more devoted to me, Roy Clemens, than to your wife and your children. You'd be angry with me if I said such a thing, wouldn't you? And rightly so. Good men don't claim that kind of devotion. That's megalomania, not goodness. But Jesus did. He told another man, sell what you have and give to the poor and come follow me. You can just imagine me getting away with that on the market square, can't you? Give all your money away and just come and follow me. You can imagine how people would react. But that's what Jesus demanded. What possible right can any good man have to demand such self-sacrifice? Is he insane? Is he evil? But you can't say he's just a good man, can you? Again, C.S. Lewis in the same article. You must take your choice. Either this was and is the Son of God, or a madman. You can shut him up for a fool, or fall at his feet and call him Lord, but don't come up with any patronizing rubbish about his being just a good man. He hasn't left us that alternative. I suppose, you see, that the most credible alternative to actually becoming a Christian, which takes account of these extraordinary claims which Jesus made and this extraordinary life he lived, is that of George Bernard Shaw. George Bernard Shaw was a wily old bird, and his view on this matter was this. Jesus was deluded, he said. He was a good man, a noble-spirited man, but he was deluded. Well-meaning, well-intentioned, but self-deceived, cruelly self-deceived. And such was the measure of his hypnotic power over others that he managed to delude them too. That's Christianity. It's founded on a delusion, he said. It has many noble qualities, many things that are admirable, many things that are genuinely good. But this idea of Jesus being God in the flesh, why, it's obvious. He was deluded. Whenever I hear people making that objection, expressing that version of the Jesus was just a good man objection, I always try to imagine what someone like the Apostle Peter would have said. If you'd gone up to them and said, "Well, Peter, I don't doubt your sincerity, old man. You're a very good fellow, and so is your master. But you're deluded." I think I know what Peter would have said. Deluded? But we saw him. Risen from the dead. We thought we were deluded, it's true, at one point. We had given up hope. We thought we'd been really had. When he died. But then he came back to life again. How can you say we're deluded when that's what we saw? Think about it, you see. Christianity did not begin in some distant corner, far away from where Jesus had been born and died and risen again. Christianity began within a few miles of the empty tomb. The best people in the world to investigate whether Jesus had in fact risen from the dead or not were those people who were in Jerusalem on the day of Pentecost when Peter stood up and started preaching. They could have asked all the witnesses, they could have asked the high priest, they could have gone to the tomb, it was only a short walk away. No one was in a better position to disprove Christianity, to prove that it was all a delusion, than those people. Yet you see, you don't find 3,000 skeptics on the day of Pentecost, you find 3,000 converts. Those early Christians were convinced he had risen from the dead. And that was no delusion, they said. It was real. Jesus, just a good man? It would be convenient to think so, wouldn't it? But when you really look at the details of it, it just doesn't fit the fact. In any case, is a good man what we really need? That brings me to my last popular objection. This is the one I find hardest to deal with, actually. Because it's expressed by people who will usually say to you, "Oh, yes, of course I do believe in God." Or even, "Well, yes, of course I am a Christian. Yes, I go to church sometimes. Christmas, Easter, weddings, funerals. And I am a very good person. I admire Jesus enormously. And I try to live like him. I mean, I remember what he said about loving one another and giving to the poor. I give to charity. Very honest, unlike some people I could mention. Yes, and I work hard too. You look at my house. Spick and span, it's wonderful. No laziness in my house. That work ethic, you know, that you Christians talk about, I've got it. No, you don't have to worry about me, Clemens. I'm okay. I do my best. And when I face God, as I'm sure one day I will, I shall explain to him that I've done my best. There'll be a great list of all those good things that I've done. I should be very proud of myself. As I say, that's a very difficult objection to meet, isn't it? Because it's not so much an objection. It's a disarming complacency. Perhaps the best way to reply to that particular objection is to actually read a story which Jesus told. It's a very short story. If you've got a Bible, you can find it in the Gospel of Luke, chapter 18. But it's of relevance because it introduces a figure precisely like this chap in our picture. "I do my best." That's enough. Luke chapter 18, verse 9. "To some who were confident of their own righteousness and looked down on everybody else, Jesus told this parable. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood up and prayed about himself, God, I thank you that I'm not like all other men, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week and give a tenth of all I get. But the tax collector stood at a distance. He would not even look up to heaven, but beat his breast and said, God have mercy on me, a sinner. I tell you that this man, rather than the other, went home justified before God. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled. He who humbles himself will be exalted. You think about it, Jesus is saying the most extraordinary thing here. See, here was that tax man feeling guilty. But Jesus says he went home acquitted. On the other hand, here was the Pharisee feeling thoroughly pleased with himself, feeling innocent. And yet, says Jesus, he went home condemned. Now that pinpoints a very important distinction, which is often confused today, between guilt as a feeling in our emotions and guilt as a fact in God's sight. See, many people, I think, treat church or treat good works as a kind of psychotherapy where they find relief from their guilt feelings. That's what the Pharisee did. He got rid of his guilt feelings by surrounding himself with good works, religious works, that made him feel okay about himself. You notice how he did it. First of all, there was a process of rationalization, you notice. He lists all the sins he hadn't committed. And this is always good psychological therapy, because it takes our minds off all the sins we have committed, doesn't it? Then he uses the technique of compensation. He tells God the good works he did, which he didn't really have to do, and which he sincerely hopes can be used to pay off any minor moral debts he may have inadvertently accrued. That, again, is very useful. And thirdly, he uses the technique of comparison. He draws God's attention to all the other people who were far worse sinners than he was. And a very handy advice. And it's amazing how subtly we fall into the same kind of trap. There's a story I love about a Sunday school teacher who was telling this story of the Pharisee and the tax collector to her children and ended her Sunday school class by saying, "Now, children, let's thank God we're not like that bad Pharisee." By rationalization and by compensation and by comparison, you see, it's very easy to evade guilt feeling. And a man who says, "I do my best," is very likely doing precisely that. But the warning of this story is this. All right, you may have masked your guilt feeling. You may have succeeded in creating a lifestyle for yourself that makes you feel okay about yourself. You may feel innocent. But how you feel may be quite unlike how God actually sees you. This Pharisee felt okay, but he went home condemned. Jesus points us here, doesn't he, to a different kind of religion. A religion which I suspect, you know, you find nowhere else in the world. Not in any other religion that I've looked at anywhere. A religion which doesn't say, "Do your best and God will accept you." But which says, if you want to go to heaven, the only thing you can do is beat your breast and say, "God be merciful to me, a sinner." Jesus came, the Bible tells us, to make it possible for people who humble themselves in that way and trust God's mercy in that very simple way to be forgiven. He came to die, to pay the price for the sins of people like that tax man who had no other prayer to pray except, "God be merciful." That's why, as I say, I find it very hard to understand how anybody can put Jesus alongside these other great religious leaders. He was different. What he came to do was different. And the message of salvation that he brings to you and me is so very different.